is kept among us in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He is affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the America Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. The men fighting on the Patriot side during the War of Independence were in something of an uncomfortable position regarding their enemies. And the same can be said of those who were fighting on the British side. Perhaps the strangest thing for soldiers fighting each other in 1776 would have been that they were fighting against men who were once their allies, men who, by and large, shared the same language, the same history, the same culture, and the same military traditions. In this series, we have often described the American Revolution as the first American Civil War. But today we are going to concentrate on the relationships between officers and soldiers in the British Army and those in the Continental Army. Men who found themselves at war with their friends, with their colleagues, and with their brethren. So, what did British officers think about their American counterparts, many of whom, like George Washington, had served in wars alongside British troops? Why did Americans who hated professional armies, who hated standing armies, end up creating their own standing army? How did the Continental Army balance military traditions with professionalization? What role did discipline, contracts, desertion, and mutiny play in shaping both armies? How did the Continental Army force Americans to rethink the relationship between military and civil power? In what ways was the Continental Army both European and American in character? And maybe we'll talk a little bit about the treatment of prisoners of war and the prevalence of war crimes in the War for Independence. And here with me today to explore the complicated histories of the British Army and the Continental Army is Dr. John Chandler. Welcome, John.
Hiya, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for being here. Dr. John Chandler is Associate Professor at University College London, where he teaches and researches the American Revolution, the history of war, and the political cultures of the 18th century British Atlantic world. His scholarship examines the creation of the Continental Army, the dynamics of civil military power in the Revolutionary period, and the ways Americans envisioned their emerging republic on a continental scale. He has published on topics including desertion, military discipline, British-American military relations, and the ideological significance of the Continental in revolutionary political discourse. And he is the author of War, Patriotism, and Identity in Revolutionary North America. A link is in the show notes. So, John, let's start by working through those grievances. The grievances against King George are broadly separated into three groups. And the final five grievances, the last two which you read, are ones that they wrote after the start of hostilities at Lexington and Concord in 1775. So let's just start with those first two that you read, though, the pre-conflict ones. So before war breaks out, grievance 11 is, he has kept among us standing armies without our consent. And then he has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. So why don't we just start by looking at these pre-conflict grievances?
Yeah, I chose all four partly because I think taken together, they show this idea that the Americans have this complicated relationship with the military, both before and after sort of Lexington and Concord, before and after the Declaration of Independence. And you're kind of with these four passages, you're seeing a little bit of some of the evolution of that. And the first two, this kind of focus on standing armies, the focus on consent, the focus to the relationship between military and civil power, I think goes to sort of the heart of the issue, which I think we'll be talking about today around sort of the creation of the Continental Army and how that plays out. The first point is that Americans and Britons, so there's a common tradition here that both British Americans and Britons in Britain had this long ideological fear of standing armies, this fear of standing armies as an instrument of tyranny and of oppression. And this is something historians talk about as sort of the Whig tradition, the English Whig tradition, which has its roots going way back to kind of classical republicanism, but in the sort of English Atlantic context really goes to the English Civil War and the fear of the standing armies then, the Stuart monarchs, Charles I, and the oppression that was caused. And that narrative around standing armies being this kind of instrument of arbitrary power again feeds right through to the 17th century and the Glorious Revolution and then onwards into the 18th century. So it's something which really underpins political thought on both sides of the Atlantic.
And if I can just give a basic point here to remind our audience, the problem with the standing army is typically, historically speaking, the tradition was you would raise an army when you were at war and then it would be disbanded. But if you have a professional standing army and you're not at war, well, what is it going to do? Well, it's probably going to be a tool of those in power to oppress people they don't like. Hence, you got to disband the standing army, right?
Yeah, it's this idea that sort of professional soldiers are sort of instruments of whoever is in command of that and ultimately whoever pays the bill. And that these soldiers can then be used as a force to impose the will of whoever's in power, in peacetime in particular. So this idea that the army could kind of be turned against its own subjects. And that's the English experience of the Civil War with Charles I as well, and this idea that their king can turn his army against him. And if you want to go to the Glorious Revolution, which is, again, 1688, big, big important moment, again, we have sort of this idea of William III coming over with a big standing army, and one of the issues of the day is how do we deal with this standing army. And the British sort of solution to this problem is to try and keep the standing army small and keep it kind of reduced in peacetime, try and keep it outside of Britain, so put it in Ireland, so kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then in Britain's kind of major conflicts in this period in the 18th century and, you know, into the American Revolution as well, relying a lot on European allies and mercenaries, and also allies and mercenaries in North America as well, indigenous allies and mercenaries as well. So this kind of, the Britain has this model of trying not to rely on a standing army because there is idea of this sort of the fear of tyranny. But that's something which the Americans have a shared intellectual tradition of as well. And so the American feeling is very much that a standing army is an enemy to their potential freedom, liberties, the rights of their legislators. And it's this decision that Britain takes to put a standing army in North America in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War in 1763, which I would argue is very much consistent with British policy. They do the same. They put a standing army in Ireland after the Glorious Revolution. They put a standing army in North America as a way of keeping it out of Britain, out of sight, out of mind. But the idea of putting that army there kind of inflames these already kind of long-standing kind of ideas. And it doesn't help that generally wherever British troops go, or just wherever any professional soldiers in the 18th century go, kind of friction happens. It happens in North America. The army is initially stationed in New York, and there's friction there in the sort of 1760s. It's then later on moved to Boston, where friction follows, ultimately culminating in the Boston Massacre in 1770. And in Boston in particular, there's lots of frictions between the army and the local populace that have kind of these political consequences. And those first two lines, are mainly thinking about what's happened in Boston, whereby by the time the Declaration has been written, the entire British army is stationed in Boston. You know, you've got 10,000 men in a city that's not much bigger than that. So it's a huge population of soldiers. Part of the problem is that when they're not on duty, they're allowed to moonlight and take other jobs. So they undercut local workers in Boston. So kind of there's an economic ramification. They form relationships with local people and sort of, which again can annoy local men if these soldiers have come in and form relationship with their wives or daughters or sisters. And so there's this kind of local tensions around kind of the army, but then also the governor, by 1774, is starting to use this army as a sort of a tool to execute Britain's policies, to enforce its tax policies in Boston specifically, which by 1774 has become the centre point of American resistance. And so this idea of essentially the military being used by, in this case, Thomas Gage, the governor of Massachusetts by this point, is being used as a tool of arbitrary power. And it kind of speaks to this long-standing history going back to the English Civil War, but also to the sort of the lived experience of Americans in Boston right there and then.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, this long tradition of not liking standing armies. Well, then a standing army appears in Boston, and then people who hate it already are saying, see, look what the standing army does. And that takes us to the grievance 12. he has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. So can you just explain that a little bit more to me?
So I think in this context, it kind of gets to the, again, one of the issues in the 1760s that the Americans are particularly angry about, which is the status of their colonial assemblies vis-a-vis the British Parliament. And as far as Britain is concerned, their military does remain subservient to the legislatures because it remains subservient to the British Parliament. So, you know, Thomas Gage in Boston is appointed by Parliament. The officers of the army are appointed by Parliament. So they are operating underneath British law. The issue the Americans have is that does not include the colonial assemblies. So the Americans in Boston, in the colonies, do not actually have any say over what this army can do beyond kind of petitioning to the crown, petitioning to parliament. And again, there's it going much earlier than sort of, you know, even the flashpoint of the American Revolution, but when the army's in New York in the 1760s, there's tensions between army and civil power there, with the army kind of issues around quartering, with the army occupying private buildings, and that the people of New York both find that are very upset about that, but don't really have any solution to that problem. And then obviously later in Boston, by the time you get the aftermath of the Boston Massacre, the Boston Tea Party, the army is kind of operating without a great deal of civilian oversight from the people of Boston. So it's this idea that actually the civil power, which in the colonies is the colonial legislatures, do not have any say over what they see, you know, the British Army. So it's becoming to them a foreign force. What they would see as their sort of military power is their sort of state troops or colonial militias, which are the things which are kind of responsibility of the colonial assemblies. What that particular phrase is doing is setting up this idea that the British Army in particular is a foreign imposing force.
And let's now just unpack what you said about the sort of the existing way that the colonies had organized their armies. Well, it was militias. Militias would be summoned. Militias would be raised to fight with the regulars, say, in the Seven Years' War. But it was, you know, local towns and villages and civil societies deciding together, we are going to muster a militia, right? And the militia will go and fight alongside the British and British native allies against the French and the French allies or the Spanish or whomever. So why don't you just unpack that kind of relationship between the colonial militias and then the British Army and their history and sort of relationships together, and then we'll get into the Continental Army, the professional one.
Yeah, I mean, the militia is actually really kind of interesting and quite, the colonial Americans have quite a complicated relationship with their militia, as I think Americans do today. The idea in their sort of collective history is that the militia has been a fundamental part of American history going back to the founding of the colonies in the 17th century. And this, again, has its roots in classical republicanism and the idea that any good republican city-state, it draws on its own citizens to raise in arms to protect that particular state. And so the Americans, in their early conflicts in the 17th century, particularly, and into the 18th century, would think about kind of the role that the militia played in fighting wars against Native Americans, as well as other wars against the imperial powers at that point. And the militia in these wars served a function of able-bodied men having training together in their sort of local communities and being organized together, and then when necessary being organized to go into bigger conflicts. And that does happen into the 18th century. In the Seven Years' War, which is the Americans' kind of most recent example of conflicts, you have this kind of, I guess, kind of intersection between lots of different types of fighting forces in North America, where you have the British Army, by this point, is sort of becomes a relatively important force in North America, the regular soldiers. But you also have these local militias who kind of work relatively in small scale in their local communities. And with the Seven Years' War, much of the fighting is in the New England borderlands, as well as Pennsylvania and Virginia and that country. So you have the militia fighting stuff in their communities. And then you have the local kind of the states raising regiments as well to fight as provincial regiments. So on a more regular setting, and these are the regiments that are kind of intended to fight more alongside the British Army on excursions into Canada and that kind of thing. And those overlap with the militia. People who are fighting in the militia might move into the sort of these state regiments and then fight alongside the British regulars. And there's a couple of major expeditions overseas. One is the Siege of Louisbourg, which is in a kind of Nova Scotia or Canada, and then there's another excursion to Cuba, which these New England men, mainly from New England, these men who are kind of militia men, but then kind of get organized into these state regiments alongside a regular army. So there's kind of these different patterns of what the militia do. And then there's also kind of a local function. The militia are also there to, essentially they're the police force. Like, you don't have an organized police force. If you need sort of someone to go and arrest something, or you have problems happening at home, you kind of call out the police force, you call out the militia.
The angry drunks at the tavern.
Indeed. And then further south, it's they increasingly have a role in policing slavery in that function. And so actually the militia kind of has quite a complicated history, actually, and it has lots of different functions, and people have different relationships to it. Because although, again, there's this idea that in the Seven Years' War, the Americans have this idea that the militia formed a really kind of important function, but also the militia wasn't necessarily that representative of society. People weren't always that keen to kind of enlist in it, and had to sometimes kind of be persuaded to do so. In the aftermath, really, of the Boston Tea Party, so it's very quite in the immediate sort of 2 years before the Declaration is when war seems like it's coming, the Americans make a kind of conscious effort to try and revive the militia, revive some of these training kind of schemes, which actually, you know, had remained dormant, like collect weapons and ensure that they had a stockpile of weapons available as well. So it's really actually kind of, although there's this kind of long history of the militia, it was really only in sort of from about 1774 that the militia really starts sort of kind of getting back together again across the colonies.
But I kind of want to go back to the Seven Years' War, because in the aftermath there was a different viewpoint. Sort of the professional British soldiers claimed credit for the victory, whereas people like George Washington and the colonial regiments and militias were like, well, the professionals in the British Army like to claim all the credit for this, but we were the ones that actually should get the credit for it. So already we're seeing, you know, although they fought together and were victorious in the war, there's already some tension forming about who gets to take credit for the victory. And I just want to pause here and maybe think about Washington's experience, because he becomes the commander-in-chief, of course, and he's fighting, and he fought as an officer. Was he in the Virginia Regiment or the Virginia Militia?
Yeah, he was a Virginia Militia officer, yeah. And then he fought alongside the British in 1775 as an aide-de-camp at the Battle of Monongahela, where the British regiment was wiped out and the British General Braddock.
1765.
55. Washington is very, very young. Early in the Seven Years' War, Washington kind of is there at this kind of major, major defeat, but the British are kind of all but wiped out. Washington survives. Washington is credited with mounting a successful rearguard action after the general is killed, and he's sort of there in the front line. So Washington is an interesting kind of example, because he does sort of encapsulate some of these issues you're talking about, where the relationship between the British soldiers, British and British officers, and the colonials was often quite strained on both sides. And the British basically looked down on the Americans as untrained and not trained in what they considered to be the contemporary warfare, which is kind of largely based around sort of manoeuvring, sort of the etiquette of siege warfare, and particularly the etiquette of kind of how you move an army around, which is quite complex at this point. And particularly British soldiers are trained with muskets, and much of the training involves how to kind of stand under fire, reload quickly and fire back kind of quite quickly, and then sort of charge with muskets. And that kind of system is kind of based around the technology of the day, which these muskets in and of themselves aren't particularly good weapons. They're very inaccurate and slow, but if you have a bunch of them together and you can kind of fire en masse together, they kind of become more effective. And then again, a bayonet charge can be quite an effective blunt instrument, but it can do some serious damage. And that's kind of how European arm warfare is designed, and kind of based around that, and alongside sort of cannon warfare as well. And the British, that's how they're trained to operate. And even though they do have some training in irregular warfare and do sort of, you know, know a little bit about how to do that, there's this, in the Seven Years' War, the idea is that the British are coming over with an aim to prosecute a war as they would in Europe. The Americans, for various reasons, probably quite sensible reasons, aren't as keen to operate in that way and pursue more of a kind of an irregular mode of warfare, less organization, partly because that mode, the British professional mode, does require a lot of training. It requires discipline, because, you know, you're essentially telling soldiers to stand under fire, which is not a thing that comes naturally. So it requires a kind of a system of command structure and quite rigid discipline to actually make that happen, which again is not something that Americans have because they don't have the same sort of training and organization. So there's a kind of a strategic kind of clash as well, where the Americans are seen by the British as being not as good soldiers, and they're kind of, you see it in a lot of the sort of the British diary entries and letters and things, with the British officers complaining about how cowardly the American soldiers are because they won't stand under fire, for example. And the Americans see the British as quite arrogant and rude, and the experience of these American soldiers is often who fight along this British is not particularly good, particularly the ones that sort of who go in these kind of excursions abroad, so the ones who are taken to Louisburg in Canada or Cuba, and the American soldiers sometimes are used as cannon fodder, or sometimes the British see them as kind of not being really worth very much, and they suffer quite heavy losses, particularly in Cuba. These American soldiers, again, mostly from New England, suffer really badly from disease, so they don't necessarily have a particularly fond view of each other. And then in the sort of immediate aftermath of the Seven Years' War, you have Pontiac's War, which is this Indian rebellion in the West, and the British, again, see that as a really big example of American incompetence, that the Americans essentially allow this rebellion to happen and don't do anything to actually put it down, and it requires British troops to ultimately suppress this Indian revolt. And so it's the combination of these kind of things, alongside the fact that the British see that the civil power, that the American colonies haven't also been particularly helpful from their perspective in terms of prosecuting this war. And they see the colonies as being quite slow to respond to sort of the threat from French Canada. They see them as slow to raise troops, and they see them as not willing to raise troops unless the British foot the bill. So the American assemblies don't, on the whole, kind of prosecute the war in the way the British expected. Whereas the Americans, as you said, have the opposite view. They think that they see themselves as being key partners in this war effort. And the British...
And another thing, the British wanted, of course, infrastructure to be built to support their actions. So the building of roads, the widening of roads, and all this stuff. And while you need to have people, workers doing that, and they need to be paid. And so the question is, who's going to do it? Well, you want this road to move your cannons, but no one's going to build the road. So then you got a problem here. So, yeah, just very quickly, what is your assessment of these opposing views, just as a historian? I mean, usually we say just there's a little bit of truth on both sides. But quickly, what do you think about these criticisms of each other in the pre-Revolutionary War period?
Yeah, so I think it is that there's truth to both sides. The Americans are right to think that they made an important contribution to the victory in the Seven Years' War. The British could not have won without them, without the contribution of American troops, without the contribution of American logistical support as well. But the British are also right that the Americans didn't make as big a contribution as they thought. The British Navy in particular made a huge contribution to that victory, but also the British on the ground. And in some senses, even though there's a much disagreement at the time about whether British tactics or American tactics were sort of the successful ones, ultimately British tactics, although there were these early defeats in the war, were successful. Britain basically won through weight of numbers and a kind of huge assaults on French Canada. But the interesting issue is essentially that to me shows this kind of polarization in the different views about what it means to be part of the British Empire and what it means to be British at this point. And the British have kind of got it ingrained in their psyche that they are the ones who won this war and the Americans were basically useless. And it's that belief, that absolute core belief, which underpins the British decision to station 10,000 troops in America and ultimately to tax the Americans in order to pay for that army. And that is unwavering pretty much throughout the 1760s. Everyone in Britain or in British political thought agrees that this 10,000 men is necessary, and then it just becomes a question of how do you pay for that, and then you kind of get into a discussion about which taxes are relevant or which aren't. In America, they do not agree that this 10,000 men is necessary because they believe they are able to defend themselves, and it comes again back to this kind of polarized view of this polarized memory of what the Seven Years' War was about. And because they can't agree on what they think the Seven Years' War is about, that kind of underpins all these other problems afterwards, is how I see it. So in some ways, I think, yeah, the idea is we should push a little bit further onto how are these people remembering the Seven Years' War. And
it's a battle. It's a battle of controlling the historical narrative, which is indeed what we are doing today, talking about the Declaration of Independence 250 years ago. And there are people who have different narratives they want to tell about it. And sometimes they agree and oftentimes they don't. And so I think it's really important to think of, at least in this military context, the run-up to the American Revolution as being a battle over a historical narrative of who's more responsible for winning the great victory over the French. That's a really useful framework to understand all of this history. Okay, but I do want to move towards now the outbreak of hostilities, Lexington and Concord, and then, of course, we have the, and now I can't remember, was the Continental Army formed before or after Lexington and Concord?
After Lexington and Concord.
Yeah. Okay, so after Lexington and Concord, the Continental Congress convenes again, and they choose to create a standing army, the Continental Army, which they're not historically don't like these standing armies, but they do. So why don't you just talk us a little bit through the choice or the decision by Congress to establish a standing army?
In some ways, Congress was forced to take action and create a Continental Army. They're kind of there. I'm sure it had probably been discussed and planned amongst the delegates, but their hand was forced by events, as often happens. And Lexington and Concord is this really important moment. It's the beginning of the American Revolutionary War, but it's also something that had been signaled. Like, people knew it was coming. There had been a series of at least three similar events, kind of called alarms, where basically the British, who by this point were pretty much encamped within the city of Boston and had made various attempts to try and get out of Boston and assert their control in Massachusetts more broadly. The militia were stockpiling weapons and the British were trying to essentially pursue a counterinsurgency operation in Massachusetts. And this is in 1774 and into 1775. And each time the British kind of left Boston, they were met with hostility. And it seemed quite likely that, you know, this is a powder keg. It seemed quite likely that something would explode. So if it hadn't been Lexington and Concord, it would have happened later. But when Lexington and Concord happened, which was, from the British point of view, a relatively routine operation, they were going into Massachusetts to seize some munitions that colonial militia had been gathering. There was also an attempt to try and seize some of the American political leaders as well. And so this kind of military counterinsurgency operation was met with resistance. And again, they'd done this before and they were met with sort of, you know, Americans in their way, but in previous attempts, nothing had happened. And it's in Lexington, Concord was the first time that someone fired a shot. And we see a conflict emerge, actually, and the British succeed in their operation. Up to a point, they manage to seize and destroy the munitions that are being held at Lexington, Concord, but then they're forced into a retreat into Lexington, Concord, where they come under heavy fire. It's basically the Minutemen, the militia in New England. The bells are ringing and people quickly descend on this, on the British column, who sustain kind of heavy casualties and require relief from the main army in Boston to get back to Boston in one piece. And then essentially these militiamen who have come from across New England descend kind of on the town of Boston, and Boston becomes essentially under siege. Again, the British have been pinned in Boston for a good few months, but it's after Lexington and Concord that the militia assemble en masse, and you have, you know, up to 10,000 men or more now kind of outside Boston. And it's at that moment where the Continental Congress in Philadelphia has to decide what to do with that militia. And it's their decision to essentially adopt that militia as a representative of their legislature, as a Continental Army underneath the power of the Continental Congress, which to me is actually probably even the more important moment than the battle itself. It's that kind of act where the Congress is essentially claiming its authority over that militia force, which, as I say, at this moment is pretty much just New England militia. But by claiming their authority over it, they are setting themselves up as a rival government to Britain, with control over an army in particular. But I think it's important to remember that period from sort of 1775 through to 1776 is still a febrile atmosphere. No one's entirely sure what's going on. Congress isn't ready to declare independence yet, even if by taking over an army it's kind of taken a step there. And we're still in a phase of where it's kind of war is politics by other means. Congress immediately sort of send a petition to the king to try and ask for peace again. So they're still trying to negotiate with Britain. Again, from the British point of view, this act is seen as an act of war. And it's in some ways, it's the British who make the next step, which is to declare the Americans in a Sikh rebellion. By 1775, there's been some attempts to negotiate with the colonists, but by 1775, in the British Parliament, there's very little sympathy left for the American position. And there's members of British Parliament who've been calling for the fire and sword approach for many years, and by 1775, they're essentially the majority. The British are prepared to essentially turn this into war. The view in Britain is that this is a sort of an isolated incident and that the majority of colonists are loyalists and that this is something that can be contained within New England with sort of decisive action. The British declare the Americans to be in rebellion. This is the Prohibitory Act, which essentially removes the Americans who are in rebellion. So not all Americans, but just Americans who are seen to be in rebellion, and takes them outside of royal protection. And that's a really significant act. I mean, that essentially declares Americans to be traitors.
Right, and that is grievance number 23 that you read here, the third one you read, mm-hmm. Which is grievance 23 in our long list of grievances. He has abdicated government here by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. So basically, this is the fourth, the Declaration of Independence, written after Lexington and Concord, after the creation of the Continental Army, is going back and saying, and this is after, you know, basically as hostilities have started, we tried to make peace, but he said, no, basically you're out of our protection and now I'm going to wage war against you. So that just kind of glosses that grievance number 23. But get back to the Continental Army, please, and the creation of the Continental Army.
Yeah, so the Americans, the Continental Congress, have a decision to make about what this militia assembled, how they'll be organized. They make a very intentional decision, both calling themselves the Continental Congress and then calling the army the Continental Army. And it's an attempt to try and ensure that this conflict, which at this stage is still localized on New England, is something that can unite the colonies behind this. And actually, it's a political act. It's an act to try and make this a sort of an existential crisis for the colonies as a whole. They could have called the Army of the United States, the Army of Congress, the American Army. And it is called those things in different places as well. But the sort of the term, the Continental Army, and this is the end, my book started with that question, why do they call it the Continental Army? Why not anything else? Is intended to create this idea that this is a war about a shared geography, not about a political ideology. It's actually about geography. It's about the need to protect their geographical interests, which is the thing at that point which they can argue unites all the colonists. Again, we're still, you know, very, very divided colonists politically. We have loyalists, we have radical Whigs, and lots of people in between, and it's not entirely clear which side is going to come out on top in that sort of domestic turmoil. So by trying to make this a war about the need to defend the American continent from a foreign invader, the British Army, this is a kind of a political act to try and make the British seem like outsiders and try and make it seem like it's a natural and coherent choice for the colonists to kind of come together in their defense. So these discussion around the fact that the Americans have been this kind of army that's outside of their civil power, the fact that there's no longer have their protections, a way of kind of casting the British as this sort of enemy, which, as we started out saying, this is quite a big shift. Like, the British and the Americans are Britons. Like, this, we're a shared nation up until 1776. Same language, same politics, same culture, same history. And so this is a way of trying to kind of create a break there. And then the very name creates this idea of a shared identity. And then the first act they do, which is appointing George Washington the Commander-in-Chief, is again a very intentional political act more than anything. Yes, Washington has military experience, not a great deal as far as people in America go, but he does have some as a militia officer in the Seven Years' War. But his main asset is that he's from Virginia, he's a Southerner. And this is an army that is almost entirely made up of militiamen from New England. So by putting a Southerner at his head and sending with him, so as Washington gets sent north and he gets sent along with a company of Virginia riflemen as well, and make that action is again a way of trying to bring the South on board and bring the South into the conflict as well.
So how professional is this, you know, in the first days and weeks as this Continental Army is established by Congress and it's kind of starting to assemble with George Washington and some Virginia riflemen? I mean, what are we talking about? Are we really talking about a ragtag bunch of farmers or what?
I mean, initially, yes. I mean, this the New England men who descend on Boston in the first minutes of the war. These are people who, some of whom have military experience from the Seven Years' War, but some of them are sort of teenage boys and men in their 20s who were children during the Seven Years' War. They've had some militia training, but this kind of the image of men kind of picking up their muskets and going to Boston to sort of to confront the British army it seems, you know, it's played out in a lot of primary sources there, and it seems to be kind of largely true. Washington kind of finds this, when he arrives, he finds the New England militia quite frustrating. He kind of talks about how they're very attached to their independence. It's very difficult to impose military discipline on them. Officers in the New England militia are elected, so there's not very much incentive for them to make their soldiers do anything. And so there's this kind of clash of cultures where, and in some ways it's, again, more sectional. It's both, Washington famously has desires on to become an officer in the British Army earlier in his career, and this comes back to what we were talking about earlier about the British perception of Americans is that Washington is never seriously considered for a post in the British Army, which he kind of holds against the British, but that he has this desire to be a professional officer like the British are. But also the southern sort of social structure is much less egalitarian. So southern militias are much more organized and hierarchical, where you have kind of gentlemen in charge and essentially working class men who are in the ranks, and they are sort of, the idea is that the southern militia is much more organized in that way, whereas the New England militia is much more egalitarian. So by putting Washington in charge of this New England, pretty much a New England militia, you immediately are creating a potential for tension. And Congress anticipate that. Like, Congress is make Washington the commander-in-chief, but he's supposedly advised by a council of officers. And these are three men, two of them are from New England, Artemus Ward and Israel Putnam, who are these both kind of veteran New England militia officers, both of whom commanded New England units during the Seven Years' War. And then Charles Lee, who is a veteran British officer, who is a friend of America, lives in America by this point, but is seen as someone with actual kind of professional experience. But Lee, even though he's a professional British officer, also thinks that fighting the war in an irregular way, using the militia, is the way to go. So you've got these kind of three people who support basing the American military campaign on the militia, versus Washington, who's coming in with his sort of own ideas. So you already kind of have sort of some tension there around what kind of the Continental Army will, how it will function, whether it will function more like a militia or more like a professional army later on.
Yeah, and the, one of the most interesting things for me you said there, of course, is this idea of following orders. I mean, if the general atmosphere of being in the militia was it's a voluntary thing, well, if I don't like what you're telling me to do, then, you know, I'm going to go home. You know, I don't like this war business anymore. And obviously, a professional British soldier doing that could be executed. So, you know, you learn very quickly that you follow orders, and that's how it is. So that's really funny. And the second thing, of course, is you said there is a sort of an atmosphere difference also in the Northern militia versus the Southern, because the Southern had already established a planter aristocracy at that point. There were the rich and wealthy and powerful who ran Virginia, and then there were the working people. Yeah. So that makes sense too. Really interesting points, John. General Gage is in charge of the British troops in Boston at this time. He's going to obviously find out that there's this new Continental Army being formed, but there are all these, also these militias floating around, and now they are engaging in open warfare. What is General Gage and what is the British officer corps thinking about what's going on? These militias that are fighting them irregularly, and then this Continental Army that's being formed.
I think the really important point is that at this moment in time, the British view the Americans who are assembled in arms as rebels. This is not a enemy force. This is a group of, a ragtag group of rebels is how they see them. And that is important both in terms of their perception of the Americans' ability. So they have a very low estimation of how strong a fighting force the Americans are going to be. The British, even after the experience of Lexington and Concord, where they don't cover themselves in glory, still believe that the Americans will kind of fall over if they experience a significant push. But secondly, the fact that they believe the Americans to be rebels has really important consequences in terms of how the war is going to be prosecuted. Because rebels are not protected under the rudimentary Enlightenment ideas around laws and nations. Like rebels, if you are traitors to the crown, and therefore can be treated essentially without any kind of rights or protections. And Britain has, remember, has recent experience of this. We have in 1745, something called the Jacobite Rebellion, where there's a major rebellion in Scotland, with Scottish, but other people kind of descending as far as Derby, which is sort of in the Midlands, and an attempt to overthrow the British crown. And the British response to that is, as you would expect, brutal. And the Scottish clans in particular are treated as rebels and decimated. And the British, you have many veteran officers from that that moment. And there's a view that the Americans needed to be treated incredibly harshly as well, and that the Americans should be essentially executed if they're caught in arms. And that's the threat that the British kind of carry against the Americans. The fact that that doesn't happen is kind of a combination of two things. One, it's that actually the Americans get the first point, in the sense that the Americans capture the fort of Ticonderoga, which is up in northern New York, and they capture the British garrison there. And that has repercussions in the fact that they capture the British cannon and they can bring that to Boston, and it allows them to prosecute the siege against Boston. But it also means they suddenly have several hundred British soldiers as prisoners of war. And the very fact that they have these prisoners allows them to act as a counterweight. So any British threat to execute American prisoners would be met in kind by the Americans against the British prisoners. So essentially stroke of fortune, essentially, the Americans take British prisoners first, and that means that the British don't prosecute a war of rebellion. And the second thing is Washington himself, but the fact that Washington, because he assumes the role of a kind of a military professional and treats the British kind of, is a gentleman and treats the British officers as gentlemen, means that the British officers form a relationship with him and ultimately are prepared to treat Washington as something resembling an equal.
That's really interesting. I hate asking counterfactuals, but I will now because you brought it up. So this capturing of the British garrison at Fort Ticonderoga, you're basically suggesting that as the first domino falls here, the Continental Army had a choice of what to do, and by having the first sort of decisive action of saying, okay, well, we have these POWs, we're not going to execute them or anything, that kind of framed the way that throughout the rest of the conflict, each side would treat the other. And had, say, all of the garrison been executed, then you would expect there would be repercussions, right?
Yes. I mean, it becomes actually a question of military ethics, which is your field, isn't it? So this question of kind of reciprocity and the fact that the Americans do make decisions, and yet again, Washington is very important here, do make decisions to not fight this as if it's as a counterinsurgency, but to fight this as if the Americans are a regular force and act like that. And it forces, in a way, the British hand is forced in that sense. And it's not uncontested in Britain. The British, and particularly William Howe, when he takes over command in 1776, William Howe wants to treat the Americans civilly, and he does his best to try and treat them, treat them well, negotiate with officers, and treat them as kind of something close to equals. But there are others who, both politicians and officers, who think that the Americans should be treated as rebels, and Howe is actually blamed or criticized for not doing that, particularly in the campaigns around New York, where he has an opportunity to essentially surround and destroy Washington and Washington's army, and he doesn't. And that's seen as kind of essentially evidence that he's too soft.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fascinating thing about civility, and this is just kind of a general meta point I'm going to make, is the act of civility in war presupposes a future beyond the conflict. And I do think that on both sides of this conflict, men, common soldiers, and officers could already imagine the post-war period and not all of these people being dead and needing to have relationships with them afterwards. And obviously the taking of POWs, the respect of a POW or the taking of a sailor, is always when you're taking him, you are forecasting a peaceful future for that person. And there are all these, but it is a reciprocal thing. And even with terrible conflicts like we see today in Russia and Ukraine, they are still exchanging POWs. So they are imagining a future It's not always war to the death here. And it's interesting, the story of Fort Ticonderoga here, which just kind of puts that in perspective for me.
I think the British in particular are in a difficult state here, because they are fighting a war to try and keep the colonies in the empire. So you're right that they are conscious that these are people that ideally, when the British win this war, they want the colonies to go back to being friends, allies, trading partners.
Subjects,
absolutely.
Loyal subjects. Okay, well, let us end now. We're talking about all this niceness. Let us end with the final grievance that you read at the very start today, which is grievance number 24. So despite the fact that there is some civility being shown, some mercy being shown on each side, we have grievance 24. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. So is this a very specific accusation that King George has authorized war crimes against civilians?
Yes, essentially. I mean, by the point that when this is being written down, in 1776, you've had Britain has been starting to use its naval power. And that's the one thing that Britain has almost the entire way through the war, with some important exceptions around the Battle of Yorktown. But Britain generally maintains naval superiority, and it's able to use that naval superiority to really ravage the American coast, as it says. I think it's a bit later than that, but there's a phrase in British military history that the British army is best used as a projectile launched from the British Navy. And that's done through this war. So basically, the British are able to move soldiers around almost at will and land and assault different parts of North America. So we have the occupation of Boston, which is under siege. We have assaults on various coastal towns in New England, Falmouth, Boston. Then in 1776, the British launched their main campaign into New York, which the British then hold for the rest of the war. You have then assaults further south in Newport, Philadelphia later on, Charleston, Savannah. Pretty much every single American city is occupied by the British at some point during the war. And the Americans are pretty much, because they have no naval strength to speak of, are pretty much unable to stop that from happening. And that is both kind of really symbolizes their kind of military or their naval weakness, in the 18th century, naval power is that the ship is the most powerful kind of military object you have. So that is a really significant weakness, which they are aware of from even before the war even starts, that that's going to be their Achilles heel. So it exposes their weakness there. And it exposes that sort of the fact that they are out of the king's protection. And much of this, the idea of the king's protection, again, is naval. And again, this has been going back sort of to the 1760s, really, is the thing that the British Empire offers. The reason you want to be in the British Empire is the might of the British Navy, the protection that offers your ships and your ability to trade across the Atlantic and have that trade protected by the British Navy from pirates, from other enemies. And that is, you know, a really important selling point, a pretty important reason to be part of the British Empire. But also, this is now being turned against them, being like, now using the British Navy against you and using the British Navy as a weapon against the North American coast. And for much of North America at this point, the colonies are reliant on, in New England, both kind of fishing and shipbuilding are big industries, but also obviously trade the whole way across.
And also, like, 85% of the population lived within, like, yep, 50 or 100 miles of the coast. Yep. So.
Yeah, this is still they're still a coastal people.
Yeah, I just wanted you to focus on the accusation of war crimes and also on the other side. So, you know, this is a pretty direct grievance. You know, I read this grievance as a basically saying that the Royal Navy, King George, the Royal Army is committing war crimes against a civilian population. So what's your assessment as a historian of that accusation, and also maybe comment on maybe some atrocities that potentially the Continentals perpetrated on British loyalists?
Mm-hmm. So in 18th century armies commit crimes against civilians. And one of the things I sort of discuss in my work is this idea that in some ways, if you're for civilians in North America, and if we say most people, at least a third of people are probably apathetic to the war and don't really want to be involved. And actually the enemy to them is not any particular side, it is armies per se. And what armies do in 18th century conflict in North America is they turn up on your land, they will kind of wreck your fields. And again, the vast majority of people in North America are farmers. So having an army march through your field or camp through your field is in itself destructive of your livelihood. But then they're also going to potentially, almost certainly, requisition food. So steal food from you, steal your livestock, steal your grain, steal any alcohol you have, or take any alcohol you have. And that's before we get to any other kind of crimes of murder, rape, sexual assault, physical assault, which again is very common.
Burning down
homesteads, taking down fences to use for fires, chopping down wood to use for fires. And if in any of the sort of, you know, primary sources around either army, British or Continental, you'll have a litany of soldiers being court-martialed for these kind of offences, of civilians complaining about these kind of offences.
There is some justice happening, though. There is some officers are at times holding their troops.
There is an attempt by both sides, and I think essentially Washington, again, is better than the British. And there's, you know, probably several reasons why that is the case. But Washington makes a more concerted effort to try and hold the Continentals to account than the British do. He's helped in this in the fact that he can work with, and he does work with, the colonial assemblies and try and have some civilian input as well. And one of the things Washington does do, even when the Continental Army come and sort of steal things from you, he'll try and ensure that you get given a receipt. Whether or not you get paid back is another matter. Whether or not you're willing to go and get your money back is another matter. But Washington will give you a receipt, which does potentially help. The thing is, Washington does attempt to be better than the British. And I think that's a really important distinction, is that Washington does try and enforce law as far as he can. He does try and ensure people are held to account for their crimes. He does try and ensure court martials take place, that people are brought before civilian courts if that's necessary. And that he does, if the army steal your wood or steal your livestock, he does try and ensure that you're given a receipt so that you can actually claim back against that, which is something that the British often don't bother to do. And it kind of comes back to where we started this idea that the British army don't necessarily see themselves as this is their people. They see themselves as fighting perhaps in a foreign war against a foreign enemy, and are less inclined to try and develop relationships with local people, whereas Washington has the foresight to realize that much of this war is about winning hearts and minds, and that if you steal a cow from someone, they're unlikely to support you in future. And even though it's often necessary for his army to live off the land, he does try and allow people to have an attempt to gain justice or gain recompense for that.
Interesting. Okay, Dr. Chandler, we've come to the end of our session today. So I ask all my guests to reflect on the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So what are your big thoughts as you look at this anniversary?
For my opinion, as someone who's a British historian who works in the American Revolution in Britain, I've often asked by Americans, why are you interested in the American Revolution? Like, why are you interested in our history? And I always say, well, it's our history too. Like, this is part of British history. It's a quite important part of British history. But it's something that in Britain is very, very kind of overlooked. And even at the time, it was something which the British were quite happy to try and forget about very, very quickly. This was a major defeat for the British Empire, a major weakening of the British Empire, a major embarrassment, both politically and militarily. And the British very quickly wanted to move on from this domestically. But then we've also kind of moved on from it in terms of our memory. It's something the British kind of very quickly tried to move away from, this idea that there's any kind of dispute between sort of the Britain and its colonies, and move towards the idea of a special relationship based on language, culture and history, with no real kind of discussion about what happened in that kind of shared language, culture and history. And to me, I think what I want to get out of the anniversary is actually thinking a bit more about what that relationship between Britain and America was like in the first place, and actually how we remember the American Revolution in Britain and as part of British history, not just as part of American history, which it obviously is, but actually as part of our own history as well, and our own memory of what Britain is and what the British Empire was. So that's how I am approaching the anniversary.
Dr. John Chandler, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Andrew.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of Liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.